We went to her apartment, and I still remember to this day my impression walking in there, and here's this woman with this beautiful apartment and all these lovely plants and the bamboo, and there on the wall in her living room is a map of Temple Square in the original antique form with all the plots of lands that were given to so-and-so and this guy and that guy, and they're marked, you know, and she's tracking. And I said, Linda, what is that in your living room? And she says, those are perpetrators. So that was my introduction to Linda as one of the most intense, focused, active, concerned, justice-loving woman that I've ever met. And I'm just delighted to have her here with us to share the results of literally years of labor in seeking out and trying to make public and seeking justice for this terrible situation we have with ongoing polygamy in Utah. Linda Walker.
And I'm not Linda. I forgot something. Sorry. Our videographer is going to be taking some shots during this session, so what we would like to ask, he's going to do some shots from the backup like we talked about, but he does want to get a minute or two of some group shots of some faces. So we want to take just a minute and ask those who do not want their face to be shown on a video, if you would move and concentrate in that back section in the back, so if he takes some shots here in the front, he won't capture anybody who doesn't want to be on film. Now, if there's a whole bunch of you who don't want to be on film, if you don't want to be shown by your face, will you raise your hand? If there's too many of you, we're not going to do the group thing then. Okay. Anyone who does not want their face shown, it will probably be a very short clip on the video, please move to that far back corner. Thanks.
Linda.
Thank you so much. We have that slide up there. I talked a little bit last night about how I started this when I fell into the deep black hole studying my own family history and studying polygamy. And this is what I had said last night, that we are the largest kindred in the world for this inherited nephritis. I started studying other things. A lot of you might remember this Jacobson. The Mormon Church is very active. When it puts in the newspaper that this is an LDS person, all their little minions call the newspaper and say, you wouldn't put it in if he was Jewish or if he was Christian or whatever, so don't put the Mormonism in. This was a Mormon man who used his own sperm he was an infertility doctor, and used his own sperm and impregnated, you know, had over 280 children that way, and this comes straight out of Mormon doctrine. He moved to Provo after he was convicted and works at a genetic center there. And then I kept studying the genetics, and I moved to Utah, and like I said, I volunteered at the University of Utah Center as a genealogist. I'm really good at making up titles for myself. And the Utah team found this rare birth defect. And I'm not expecting you to read these slides other than the headline. Listen to me. But this came out of a Montana, Idaho, and Utah kindred. So this is another genetic defect that we're seeing from descendants of polygamy or even people who are continuing to practice polygamy. This is a large study out of the University of Utah, the largest study ever done on Tourette's syndrome. I tried to get hired onto this study but failed. But this study was done in the Warren Jeffs community, the FLDS. Nowhere in the scientific research in Utah do they identify that they are studying polygamous kindreds. And monogamous kindreds and polygamous kindreds are nothing alike. So as the public, what is happening, genetic diseases are some of the most expensive to manage. So if you're a scientist at the University of Utah studying one of these orphan diseases, and the incidence in the population, as what happened in my own kindred, the incidence in the population was thought to be 1 in 25,000, so the National Health Institute won't give you as much money to study it as if the incidence is 1 in 5,000, you're going to get more money because more people are affected. So these phony studies are raising the disease incidence. So in my own kindred, during the time that I was studying the disease, the scientist said it went from 1 in 25,000 to 1 in 5,000. It's BS all the way. I don't know where I got the guts to challenge these PhDs. They don't agree with me because their research dollars are at stake. But we as the public are paying for this. This is a sideways, Kathleen, or can it be turned? This is the very sad photo from the 1953 raid in the Utah Historical Archives. His little boy's name is Rumel. He didn't live that long. You can see huge bump on his foot. Children in the FLDS are still being born in this condition, and the families have many children that are born this way, but you don't see them because they don't bring them out in public, just like their sister was, or locked in the basement. And how did they get this way? Well, this is a LeBaron genealogy, and as you can see, Ezekiel Johnson and Julia Hill are on both the paternal and the maternal side. And I found this repeatedly studying the genealogies, the uncle-niece marriages. And so, you know, it's just not sound to have the same grandparents on the maternal and paternal side. Everybody knows that except the geneticists at the University of Utah, where all these public relation articles come out about them studying Mormonism because they are so good at researching their ancestors. No, it's because there's so much consanguinity, marrying of their relatives. I think this might be out of order, but this is the Kingston Group. The Kingston Group was the first fundamentalist group I penetrated. The people in the Kingston Group were getting script. A lot of this has been in Utah newspapers. They didn't get paychecks. They got paid in script. They turned everything over to the group. I talked to some women about getting their own bank accounts. And women who worked as teachers in the Kingston Group and had never had their own bank account, they turned everything over to the cult. So this shows some of the leaders of the cult. Brigham Young preached uncle-niece marriages, and these cultist groups are also preaching uncle-niece marriages. And the reason they're doing it is, this is from a Kingston defector, that J.O. Kingston, who had all those marriages, he teaches that the real reason for polygamy is to breed a master race, or as he words it, royal blood. More than 30 years ago, he started uncle-niece marriages with predictable results. About half the children were normal, and as for the defects, most were minor, such as bad eyes or no fingernails. But a very high percentage were so bad that they had to kill the baby. And some were so horrible they wouldn't even let the mother see it. A few were blobs of protoplasm. They blame all of this on the mothers, that they were not righteous enough. The Kingston Group and the other polygamous groups are having the patriarchs deliver the babies in many instances. Okay, let's take a minute to breathe. It's horrifying information. Horrifying. You can't believe what Mormonism has wrought. I should be a little more forward so I can see where we're at in the presentation. This is the LeBaron group, and I think you've probably, most of you have read about this. This is from a law enforcement training that I do. I have a lot of these case studies in this format, and I have homicide cops falling out of their chairs. I mean, these are hardened guys with this information. I really feel sorry for all of you having to listen to me here today. But you can see there's many known victims of this group. They've blood atoned defectors and rivals. The family's extremely inbred, very crazy. They have all kinds of, you know, problems. And this is an article that ran, questions will be after the presentation, in the LA Times. Ervil died in the Utah State Prison, thankfully. 13 wives and 58 children. And one of the things I say to the cops is, imagine you're after a cult group, because these people ran drugs between Mexico and Arizona and Texas where they were organized. I said, a man practicing polygamy can have 10 boys, all the same age, all looking alike, all alibiing one another. How do you ever get a conviction? And then this is Ervil LeBaron's just genealogy with one as the child of Alma Dyer. But you can see up there number 10 is Benjamin Franklin Johnson. He was on our other slide. I found in my ritual abuse study that I eventually studied over 100 people claiming they came from ritual abuse that was practiced in their families for many generations. And these were not polygamists. These were in the Mormon church, in the LDS church. The most often ancestor I saw was Benjamin Franklin Johnson, who married three sisters, I think. Continue on. Oh, okay. I don't have any more. Then, this is when the start of my ritual abuse study in 1990. I don't know how many of you are aware of the big brouhaha, satanic ritual abuse. If you believe this, you can believe anything, or are aware of Glenn L. Pace's memo about ritual abuse. I wanted to get some copies of it, but at any rate, we broke that memo in 1990, and the church was studying ritual abuse. Glenn L. Pace, who was at the time the presiding bishop of the church, called me up and came to see me because he was interviewing the same people I was interviewing, so he heard my name. He came to see me. He asked me, what could the church do about it? I said, pay a lot more attention to the living and quit being such a necromancing church. Wait, did we get the picture of Russell Frazier? Did we have that up there? Oh, okay. So this man, I interviewed two ritual abuse survivors who were out of the same group. Corey Hammond, who's a psychologist at the University of Utah, gave me their names. And everyone I interviewed, I asked, you know, do you know anybody else I can interview? But they said that they were abused by a doctor and that their family members worked at Kennecott Copper. And Russell, my promise to the people who gave me their information was, let me see if I can find evidence. They thought themselves that they were crazy when they would tell me I was satanically ritually abused. But that can't be. I must be crazy. But I didn't come from that attitude. I came from the attitude, let me see if I can find evidence to substantiate your memories. So they had named this man. He's a prominent community leader and an active member of the Bingham Canyon Clavern. So now we can go on. So this is 1950 to 1963. The sect was LDS, Methodist, and KKK. That criminal activity is listed. The known perpetrators are listed, those that are dead. The head of security at Kennecott Copper, later sheriff in Vernal. All good Mormons. Want to read you here from the survivor's statement. She writes church leaders to please remove her name from the records of the church, that although she doesn't hold them responsible for her father's participation in the occult, she states, I cannot forget that my patriarchal blessing states that I was born of noble parents with whom the Lord is well pleased. At the time I received this blessing, my father was involved in many criminal activities, including rape, child prostitution, and homicide. In short, I am no longer willing to place my salvation in the hands of men who claim the authority to speak for God and then provide criminals with a mantle of respectability and honor. And this is what I have found throughout my studies. The accidental deaths and the suicides, the different things that I've heard about are, they just stretch the imagination of any layperson, which I am. But the sheriffs, the coroners in Utah, they seem to have no problem ruling all of these things accidents. One of, had a daughter who fell asleep under a pile of leaves and was accidentally burned to death. Ruled an accident in Utah. Anyway, the number of accidental, suicidal, and strange deaths that I have been told about corroborate the memories of these survivors about their brutal family histories. This is another one. Imagine saddling a son with the name John Wilkes Booth. Have I dropped into white supremacy land here or what? We're in Mormonism, folks. I know it's not all Mormons. I'm in the criminal underbelly of Mormonism, but they are operating as stake presidents and area presidents and bishops. Keep going. Here again, gosh, I hope he's dead. Anyway, he's a ritual abuse perpetrator, KKK and Mormon. Again, you see, going back to Benjamin Franklin Johnson and Melissa LeBaron. It's absolutely phenomenal, the evidence that I, as a layperson, could find, when the Utah Attorney General's investigators could find none of it. Matt Jacobson, who was the investigator, came to see me. I was living in San Francisco then. I had a lot of serious cases that I thought needed to be criminally prosecuted or at least looked at. He was far more interested in seeing the sights of San Francisco than in listening to me on his public dime. This shows Benjamin Franklin Johnson with the children, with each wife, 47 children in all. He married three sisters. All of those children are double cousins. They're just as genetically related as a sister and brother. So they're in this small cult group. Imagine what happens 2-3 generations down the line, which we are now, where we are at now. This is a man who came out of the Reformed Church and joined polygamy. He had his Army of Israel. These guys think of the most grandiose names for their cults. He killed 5 members. The classic indoctrination methods included isolation, humiliation, degradation, forced women and children to perform sex acts, and dance behind the veil. This dancing behind the veil was in the Shreve case in Utah, which I don't have a slide of. And in a lot of different ones. You can see designated his son as a two-star general and was poised to implement a military takeover of the Kirtland Temple. Particularly love this next slide. In many cases they have, the jury recommends death for cult leader Lundgren. Every case that I'm going through today has been in the newspapers. I'm showing you the genealogies and kind of the development of my thinking because we're all Mormons here. I use the newspaper articles, or ex-Mormons, sorry. I use the newspaper articles more in other trainings, and this is a mishmash of three trainings, all of which are a couple of hours each, and you guys are just getting sort of a snapshot view of what I think has been going on in Mormonism. And again, not all Mormons, of course not. And in fact, I think of the good Mormons, many Mormons are, to me, are actually Christians, but they don't know it. They're in a cult. And they're the ones who provide the cover for this criminal activity because people will say, oh, my neighbor's a Mormon and that's a very good person. And yes, but all the millions of minions are providing the cover for this criminal activity. And mind you, this criminal activity comes straight out of the first people who joined Mormonism. This one I really love. Can you move it over a little to get the death mask the other way? Move it so we don't need to see the writing. Yeah. Okay. One of the things Jeffrey Lundgren told his followers was that he had this mantle because he looked so much like Joseph Smith. And I come across that, the Joseph Smith death mask on one side. Talk about necromancy. They make death masks that keep people out of the ground for days. Weeks, they moved my grandmother to three different places for a funeral on the train from Utah to California. I mean, it's horrifying to me. But you can see how much he really does look like Joseph Smith, the lookalike in the two. So he used that to convince his followers that he really had the mantle. This is the last slide I'm going to show from my ritual abuse study. And a woman called me in a panic on February 2nd. I did a date analysis of this ritual abuse study, which I really can't go into now, but February 2nd is one of the dates that I use to analyze the ritual abuse. It's called Candlemas, and many Mormon survivors reported to me that particularly terrible things happened on this day. And so I told this woman that in a few days her anxiety and panic attacks would pass because this was a holiday when likely her cult group had done particularly horrible things. And I asked her, I said, do you have any idea what their name is? You know, because I was trying to identify and find evidence. She said, let me ask inside. And she sent me this drawing saying that she asked inside, the people that I interviewed have parts of themselves that have remained children. They're so traumatized that they haven't grown up. And then they have other parts that present as an adult person. And many of these people you have run into and you wouldn't even know that they were ritually abused because they're not presenting that way. I interviewed a policewoman in Utah. I interviewed therapists, social workers, people, you know, who had severe mental health problems from the abuse they suffered, but whom you would never know. So note that the picture, the underlined part, says Brothers of Arion. And she said they used to chant this, Brothers of Airy on, and she spelled it phonetically like a kid would, the Aryan Brotherhood. There's no question but that she was in another white supremacy cult involved with the Mormons. So ritual abuse among Mormons and Mormon offshoots is linked to racism and serious crimes against children. And what I found out from 10 years of that study and over 100 interviews made me really angry. And I decided, because I was saying, has this been prosecuted? Was this prosecuted? Well, my dad was arrested for cruelty to animals or minor offenses, but in a lot of these cases, no, it was not prosecuted. So I decided, well, we've got to start holding the Mormon Church accountable for this child abuse. And at that point, there were starting to be articles in the paper about the civil claims against the Catholic Church. And I started calling attorneys and saying, we have to sue the Mormon Church. And so this is a case that was in Beckley, West Virginia. The church settled for an undisclosed amount. The reason you're not reading about these cases the way you're reading about the Catholic cases is because the church settles them on the doorsteps of the courthouse right before trial. They take the victims through the maximum trauma that they can take them, filing specious motion after specious motion in the courts until they cannot avoid trial. Our attorneys, the attorneys I work for, are like, ready for trial, ready for trial, ready for trial. And the Mormons are still filing their specious motions in the courts. What this does is causes the maximum trauma to the victims. And this is the law firm that I work against is the Curtin McConkie Law Firm. And they hire attorneys in the different states to work with them. I don't know how those guys sleep at night, knowing what they know in these cases and having acted the way they act, and yet they hold high positions in the Mormon Church. So this Blair Meldrum was the stake president when the children went in to Raleigh General Hospital with their physical damages of abuse. The CEO of the hospital was a Mormon. We had complete collusion with the nurses, the hospital, the stake president. All of them knew and did nothing to help these children. Yes, it was. It was actually filed as a $750 million civil suit against Mormon church leaders because they knew for 5 years. In July of 1989, the babysitter learned of the abuse, going back to the last one, from the children and made an audio tape of their allegations, which she then asked the father for $20,000 to keep silent. Even the babysitter wouldn't protect the children. Let's take a few deep breaths. It's the stepmother was too frightened of the father to report the sexual abuse of the children. Nothing was ever reported. It's not an isolated incident, and it's not an unusual handling of child sexual abuse within Mormonism. The caveat to do nothing to harm the reputation of the church takes precedence over the protection of the children. Oh, I didn't know that that one was next. This is a case out of Rexburg, Idaho, where the church has a college. It wasn't until there was a rape crisis center in the neighboring county that people felt able to come forward. They've documented about these are really old slides. Like I said, I haven't spoken in public for a long time. But 117 complaints and growing. They had about 400 complaints at the end. Now, let me see if I can get what happened in that case was everybody was Mormon. The doctor was almost ready to retire. and they did eventually take away his license to practice medicine. Nowhere to turn. This is from the Idaho Statesman. For 30 years, Eastern Idaho women whispered about an abusive doctor. Huge report on this in the Idaho newspaper. Now we're in Rexburg, Idaho. All the prosecutors are Mormon. Let them off lightly. When the civil suits came, it was a Mormon attorney who got the civil suits from these true-believing Mormon women. Who did they sue? They sue the public trough instead of the Mormons. The Mormons cause this problem. The Mormons cover up this problem for years and years and years. Then they get a Mormon attorney who sues the hospital and the county. It was the hospital and the county who finally brought the case to light. But this Mormon stake president, with all these civil cases, isn't going to sue his church. So what I've seen in several cases, another case I don't have up here, in Illinois, similar case of a teacher who was abusing children in the school and in the church. The church knew all about it. When the school district was sued, they called me, and I was telling the school district attorneys, this is one of the things that really angers me about the Mormons. They cause this problem, then they look to the public to pick up the pieces. And I encouraged the school district to sue the Mormons, because it really was not the school district's fault. The Mormons knew first. This was the first case that I worked on. He was a stake president. He was an oncologist. He had a big reputation as an oncologist for curing cancer. Talk about fraud schemes in the Mormons. How did he cure these women's cancers? Why was he such a great oncologist? Because he diagnosed women with cancer who did not have cancer and then pronounced them cured. After years of their suffering with chemotherapy treatments. Sickening. Disgusting. Words can't describe how I feel about these people. The woman who brought it to the attention, very brave teacher in the ward, went out and started getting women's statements and brought them to the area president. And what the women in the ward were saying is 500 affidavits from women don't mean anything next to one high priest's word. And that is absolutely the truth in Mormonism. This is a case I worked on out of San Luis Obispo, Santa Maria, California. San Luis Obispo was the court area. This was an attorney, a Mormon attorney, who took public cases of children, and he would tell these teenage juveniles in trouble that because he was taking their case for free, they owed him something. And so these are already children in trouble who've been abused, and he abused them as payment for his services as their attorney. He also abused, the really revolting thing about this case is that the stake president was an FBI agent. I don't know how many of you know, but in most states, every single one of us is a mandated reporter of child sexual abuse. We do not have to know if the abuse is really taking place. That is left up to the police and the social workers and the CPS workers to decide. We are to report it to the proper authorities so that it can be investigated. Nolan Phillips, especially an FBI agent. Nothing was done. They weren't alert to this predator and their flock. And this Michael Rechtsheen also went to prison and had his license to practice law removed. And I went to Texas. Oh, boy. The church in Texas. Woo! I was deep in KKK country there. The police kicked me out of town. I was sitting in my car on a public street, I thought. But this was two Mormon high priests. I was hired. Two Texas attorneys came out to see me in San Francisco. And I said, you know, you need me to investigate this because I speak the language. I can get the information that you need to win the case. And I'm investigating this John Blome, this perpetrator who went to jail. And in this case, the Mormons usually always settle on the court steps, but they thought they could beat this case. They didn't think that we had that strong of a case. The attorneys were asking for $3 million in damages. The jury awarded $4 million. They were so outraged. This is how out of touch Kurt and McConkie are with what's really going on in the public. This is the first perpetrator there, John Neely. The first case I was investigating was this John Neely, who a lot of the evidence in these cases doesn't get into the trial record because we don't need it to win the trial and because it's so horrifying to the public. But he committed bestiality. Bestiality has been a fact in many of the cases that I have worked on. I also work on the Catholic cases. I'd rather work on the Mormon cases because it's their money I want to grab. But I can tell you that the cases in Mormonism are sadistic and very sick compared to the Catholic cases in general. The facts in the Mormon cases are much more heinous. Because the Catholics are, to me, a real religion, that's not to say that cults aren't operating within Catholicism, but there's a broad spectrum of the Catholics. They're all along the political spectrum. The Catholic people have demanded, when they have found out about what their church was doing, they have demanded their church to reform. The Catholic people have really stepped up to the plate on their church child abuse cases. They have taken out full-page ads in newspapers apologizing to victims. They make public apologies from the pulpit. The Catholic Church has acted in a mature way. That's not to let them completely off the hook, because we still have cases against them and they're going to be ongoing. But I worked on the $45 million settlement against the Spokane Archdiocese. It bankrupted them. And the people still told their hierarchy, do something about this. We do not want this treated in the same manner that it has been. Can you imagine the Mormons being able to tell the 12, do something about this, take out ads, apologize in every ward? Mormons need to grow up. Well, he got life imprisonment for child abuse. That tells you what happened. I mean, in St. George, Utah, one of the polygamists got 5 days for raping five daughters. 13 days, I mean, for raping five daughters. Let's, can we hold the questions to the end? Oh. Well, the molestation took place in the ward house, and this has happened quite often that the molestation takes place in the ward house. In fact, Bishop Pace told me that they had to start locking the wards and the stakes because of the number of people who were using them after hours for molestation. By the lawsuits, absolutely. The case was prosecuted with 8 children, but in these cases, I'm hired to find the evidence, but I'm often not, you know, given the resources to go all the way back. But there were known child victims over 18, and 3 boys are in some form of incarceration. Child abuse is the number one problem in America. The most serious offense landed one boy in federal prison for converting a semi to an automatic gun. The children come out so traumatized, they cannot function as regular citizens. That's not to say every child abuse victim doesn't recover or become a good citizen, but it's not to say every child abuse victim is in prison, but it is to say that nearly every prisoner was a child abuse victim. And this is something that we just can't afford. Let's see, we can skip through these. Actually, this is from the Houston Chronicle, and it does show the case I already talked about, the molested boy wins more than sought against the church, $4 million at the bottom of the page. So remember those stories about don't accept candy from strangers? This pedophile stood at the exit doors of the church passing out candy to the children. It's pretty amazing. Well, we were, there's one case I didn't talk about. It's a very important Oregon case. Franklin Richard Curtis was a man who spent his whole life in prison for attempted murder. He was a small-time gangster in Chicago. And at 56 years old, they let him out. He's harmless. He hopped a bus to Utah. He probably met some of Mormon people in prison as they go in there and try to convert. Hops a bus to Utah, and I need to know about time also. Okay. So I just wanted to know if I had enough time to tell this story. There's actually going to be a book written about this case. It's we were very excited about this case, but the victim that we had wasn't strong enough to take the case all through trial, and he got dollar signs in his eyes and settled for $3 million. But this perpetrator was a lifelong prisoner. Hopped a bus to Utah, met the missionaries, a con men conning con men is what it was, fell down on Temple Square, picked up by some elderly missionaries, said he had no money, his money was on the way, they gave him money, they fed him, said he was just so awestruck by Temple Square that he certainly wanted to be baptized. So they give him money for bus fare up to Oregon, where he wants to go live. Introduce him to the bishops and whatnot there. Get him a job. Make him a high priest. He's in his 50s. He deserves to be a high priest. So now this guy has total mantle of respectability in the Mormon church. Deserved? Oh. So unreal that you just, I can't even believe the facts in these cases. Protected by the church for 30 years, didn't die until he was in his 90s. You wondering how he sodomized boys when he was 90 years old? 3 penile implants. That is how compulsive this child sexual abuse disorder is. Ruined, this was one of the saddest cases I worked on. We did focus groups on this case. Oregon has something called punitive damages. And punitive damages are like in the tobacco suits where the tobacco companies, when they've got the evidence that they knew all along that it was causing these problems and they did nothing about it, they were hit with these heavy punitive damages. We did focus groups, 3 focus groups with juries in this Oregon case. I wish we could have gotten this to trial because I'm still looking for this case in my career. The juries gave us $3 billion in punitive damages, but we didn't get to trial. That's how outraged the juries are by the facts that we are finding in these cases. And they are horrifying. Franklin Richard Curtis, this Oregon perpetrator, they pick on single women with children. And this young boy's father had just died. And his father used to take him fishing, and so this perpetrator took this young boy fishing and molested him, and he can no longer fish. He's also dying of hepatitis C. Let's go. Anyway, we were emboldened by that Oregon case. Jeff Anderson, who has a case against the Catholics at the Vatican now, which is about as high up as you can go in the Catholic cases. I was very proud to have been working with him and Tim Kosnoff, and they go, let's go to Utah, let's take some Utah cases. I said, guys, it won't work. You can't win in Utah. It took them 4 trips to Utah and meeting with many attorney firms. Every time we came out of a meeting, they were like, oh, that firm's going to help us. They're going to take the case because these are attorneys from other states. They have to have a Utah firm to help them. I said, nope. Came back again. They thought, yep. I said, nope. I could read these guys better than they could, having come from the background. We did finally find an attorney who was willing to take the cases. We filed 3 cases. The Utah Supreme Court basically told us that the church cannot be sued in Utah. Is this a state? Is there freedom and democracy here? Do we practice civil law here? So these were, I just am running through them just to show you that we did try to sue the church in Utah. And when victims contact me, my first question is, where did the abuse take place? And if they say Utah, I say, and any other state on summer vacations, anywhere else? So is this the Gordon Young one or what? We went through these 3 lawsuits in Utah where we basically got smashed. And then this is a case, a recent case in Washington that they also allowed to go to trial because they thought it was a weak case. What does it say up there? $4.2 million. Weak case? Get another clue. I don't know if they've got somebody from Curtin McConkie's office here listening to me today. They know very well who I am. They try to get me fired off of cases. They've once got me successfully fired off of a case by attorneys who didn't realize my worth to them. And then this is another recent case from Washington. I work a lot with Tim Kosnoff This is Ken Fleming. Ken Fleming, although he's a gay man, is such a likable person that the bishops could not lie. They couldn't lie about knowing about his perpetrator. And it was a highly unusual case because in case after case after case, we proved that the bishops are lying, that they knew all about it, that the stake presidents are lying. We cannot get civil damages unless we can prove that the church knew all about this and that they were negligent. And these are not cases that have the priest penitent privilege, because if the perpetrator comes in and tells the bishop, oh, I have this problem, I'm molesting children, the bishop doesn't have to tell that. The penitent privilege can apply there. But in these cases, the victims, the mothers, the fathers are coming in and telling the church, do something about this. And they're saying, we'll take care of it, and doing nothing and encouraging the families not to report the child sexual abuse. Let's not quite move on yet. In an interview, Ken Fleming said that LaHolt made plaster casts of his genitals, posing him provocatively and sodomizing him repeatedly. But at 19, before embarking on his own work as a missionary, he said he finally told Mormon Bishop Richard Pettit. He apologized, Fleming recalled. He said they'd known about Jack, and then he specifically asked, do you know if he abused my children? Covered it up for them, and is worried that his own children might have been victims. There's a lot other civil cases that I've worked that a horrible Simi Valley case, one of the girls, bishop's daughter, was so abused that she pulled all of her hair out and had to wear a wig. The cases are just horrifying, and nearly every bishop's daughter was abused by that perpetrator in that case. We can see this running throughout the church. I think that Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants, it would be, I don't know if this is a goal I would ever reach in life, but to have the church acknowledge that that is a false doctrine and that that needs to be taken out of the church. That says in Section 132 that any man may espouse 10 virgins. Now people are going to say, I'm taking it out of context. Of course they have to be given unto him. But, that's what these men are doing. And I think the Mormon Church appeals to the authoritarian personality, to the type of very rigid personality that can't admit, like I can admit, oh gosh, you know, I shouldn't have said that. I did something wrong, you know, and I should have been more careful. But these guys don't have that ability. It's black and white with them. They can lock their daughter in the closet and rape her on Saturday night, and they can stand on the pulpit on Sunday morning, all the while telling her, this isn't me raping you, this is Satan in me. These are people who attribute everything bad to Satan and everything good to God. If you're a 3-year-old child and your father's telling you, it's not me, it's Satan in me, that child's going to grow up and report that it was Satan, because she has to live with that perpetrator. She's dependent on that perpetrator for her very life. So what can she do? And that's where the satanic ritual abuse allegations came from. They're very easy to explain. I cannot tell you why the media didn't explain them adequately, but everybody who hears from me says you're the first person to ever make sense of it. And, you know, it does make sense. Anyway, I started a thing called Child Protection Project to put some of the cases on the web. I was so upset about what was happening. And I was looking for, in these, all of these cases, I had found a lot of crossover into polygamy through Mormonism. In the Texas case, there was a brother Black who was telling the single women, do you want, he was a high priest running through the stake, do you want a part-time husband? I can get you a part-time husband. Polygamy is being proffered in the church continuously. At singles dances, women are being, you know, coming across these polygamous men. So Child Protection Project has an interest in the law and in laws that could protect children. We are against religious exemptions in the law. We think that everyone should be held to the same secular standards. And so this work, I wanted to start educating the media and talk about polygamy, but they weren't interested in talking to me because I didn't come from polygamy. So I started looking for somebody who came from polygamy to run Child Protection Project. And I met Flora Jessup, and it was all over. It took me a year to convince her, please direct this organization. Please, 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 I need you, I need you. And the two of us are cut from the same cloth. She's an absolute firebrand. I want to give her a few minutes to speak, and then she can answer some questions. We've been doing a lot of work to try and bring the attention. We think that it's possibly some of this information that we turned over to the FBI on the FLDS over 2 years ago. Can you pull that down just a little bit? This was a small article. We haven't really gotten this story out yet. We're hoping that we'll be able to get this story out in the news media a lot more. But Flora, I went in and documented all the graveyards in Colorado City. They have a baby graveyard. Flora has told me she said that she used to ride her horse through the baby graveyard. Name me a town in America that has the need for a baby graveyard. So they also have the Isaac Carling graveyard. So we, stay with that for a minute. So there was going to be a lot of news media in Colorado City, and I told Flora, we were trying to think of how we were ever going to get this documentation. And I said, you know, everybody's going to be at that news conference, the cops and everybody. So I went in that day with a video camera and documented every grave, and then we pulled our statistics from that. And then we tried to get the states to cooperate with us. Death records are not public information. This is another law that we would like to change. They used to be public information. The Democrats are just put a pitch in for my Democratic leaning. Democrats are much more into open records than Republicans. And the death, birth, and marriage records in Utah and Arizona are closed records. We've even had a state legislator try to get the records in these two zip codes, Hilldale, Utah, and Colorado City. And he's been turned down. Our Freedom of Information Act was turned down. What we found out, I'm just going to read you this, is that a review of the deaths reported for the town, Colorado City, between the years of 1996 and 2001 indicate child deaths consistently made up a large proportion of the death rate. And while the total numbers are small, which may be exactly why they've gone unnoticed by officials for so long, they are disproportionate. In 2000, there were 7 reported deaths in Colorado City, and 4 of those were children. To put it in perspective, 585 total deaths were reported for Havasu in 2000, which has a population more than 10 times the size of Colorado City, yet only 7 of its 585 deaths were of children. If Havasu's death rate were 57% children that year, like Colorado City's, over 333 children would have died. So then, these are some of the percentages that we have gotten. 66% of the children are dying. It's genetic. It's child abuse. It's accidents that are really murders, that are homicides that are being treated as accidents by coroners and authorities who ask no questions. It's absolutely unbelievable. We took this information into the FBI in Phoenix. We're treated absolutely horribly. Flora and I, we're always thinking of fun things to do. Oh, let's go turn our information into the FBI today. So now you can flip to the next one. Oh, wait, the FBI letter. I think we already might have flipped past it. This is a photograph of the grave. You can see in the lower photograph, the way I identified that these were unmarked baby graves is they're just small mounds. They don't level them off. They just leave them as small mounds. So we turned all of this evidence into the FBI, asked them to declare it a crime scene. Oh, they loved that. Open a formal investigation into the situation that exists for children in Colorado City. They tried to laugh us out of their office. This is where I'm going to let Flora take over. How much time do we have, Sue?
Well, it's about 25 to 40.
Okay. Okay. These two graveyards that we documented are not the only graves in Colorado City. People are using home burial plots. They are burying their children in the canyons. They are doing all, you know, just on what we have is the tip of the iceberg. This is not actually what's happening. Flora has worked very, very hard to bring public attention to this, and many of you have probably seen her on television. She's an absolute pistol. I love her to death. I'm so happy that she's engaged in this work, and she can tell you a little bit more about what we're finding out about the descendants of Mormon polygamy. Flora Jessup!
Hello. The previous picture. The previous picture. This picture was taken August 31st when I went up trying to find my mother. And I took an Arizona state legislator in to who had been helping us try and get the documentation of why the children are dying. And what we found were a bunch of graves that had been dug up. They are also taking tractors and leveling the mounds now so that we can't tell where the graves are. We had probably 36 fresh graves in the cemetery, and yet there have been no reports of anybody dying. Well, there were 36 fresh graves. I mean, it was like the dirt had not been rained on. I have no idea. Because that day, the mounds looked like they had not, it had not rained on the dirt. Could have been the day before. What we're finding is reports of night burials, lots of them. This has been reported for years. One of the things that we've also found is that they are disposing of a lot of child graves. They They report that the children are lost souls because they didn't get to be blessed by the priesthood if they're stillborn, so they just destroy the graves. Children aren't lost souls. These people believe that their children are disposable because they can have more. One of the cases that I've been trying to work on for since 2004 was the case of a young man who was going to come forward with to back up the allegations of Brent Jeffs against Warren Jeffs on the sexual abuse. And this kid ended up going over a 500-foot cliff with 50 foot of rope. He was an experienced rappeller. The coroner on that case is actually the investigator out of the Washington County Sheriff's Office that was assigned to my sister's rape case. And they have deemed that an accident. The Mojave County investigator that's been assigned to investigate the crimes in Colorado City has told CNN, everybody he can talk to, I've stood in those graveyards and there is nothing wrong up there. He's also living now with a priesthood member in Colorado City. So we have no help there. As a matter of fact, he is now threatening the women coming out to keep their mouths shut. That's why we are losing the cases in Mojave County. The women and children that are coming out of Colorado City and Hilldale are being threatened again by the government. They're being sabotaged by the attorney generals of Utah and Arizona. What we have happening is they've set up a safety net committee received a $700,000 grant to offer aid to the women and children coming out to help them get out of the abuse. However, the only thing they help them do is lose their children back to the patriarchal father. If a woman comes forward and reports the abuse is occurring, she is institutionalized. They are using several institutions throughout Utah, Nevada, Idaho, Arizona, and Colorado that I'm aware of. And part of the release condition from the institution is that they go and counsel with their prophet, Warren Jeffs. And this I have documentation, his name, in their release paperwork. And these are state-run facilities. We go to court, and the judges state, we are not going to discuss religion. It has no place in this courtroom. They tell us, I feel your frustration. I feel your pain. I've been investigating this for 8 months, and I know exactly how you feel. You file a missing persons report on someone, a family member, and they have to go and ask permission from the Colorado City Police to investigate it. They told us they are so busy they want to be their friend, so they'll cooperate. Every case, we have 60% of the graves in Colorado City and Hilldale are children 10 and younger. And we don't have the right to know why they're dying. There are numerous kids that have been run over. It's always their head, though, that gets run over. Every one of these cases is termed an accident. This is a death cult for children. The average lifespan for women in Colorado City is 32 years. 32 years of age. It really sucks to be a female in there. My grandmother was one of the blood atonements that I know of. She stood up against the sexual abuse that I was experiencing, and she was dead 2 days later. She was on kidney dialysis, and she had so much salt put into her machine that she died. It crystallized her heart when it went through her system. And then I spent 3 years having them tell me that if I would have kept my mouth shut, she would still be alive. I believed for years that I was responsible for the most important person in my life dying. When they take children to help understand why it is so difficult to escape from this nightmare, they take the children, the babies, because they have decided God finds crying babies offensive. God finds laughing babies offensive too, but crying babies, they teach them not to cry by 6 to 15 months of age. And you do that one of two ways. You repeatedly slap their faces until they quit crying, or you hold their faces under running water. They can't breathe, they can't cry, and we have had children die during this treatment. I swore as a child that I was never going to have more children than I could protect. Two was going to be my limit. I had one. And I ended up with two because I have a stepdaughter. When 6 years ago when I started to fight for these children, I had to rethink my parenting because the way these guys work, they're not going to come after me. Although they do, I've had many fun instances where we've dealt with bullets flying and things like that. But I just think they need to get a better target to shoot at. I just turn sideways and they can't see me. But the way they work is they're not going to come after me because they don't like somebody who fights back. They're schoolyard bullies. They don't like somebody fighting back. They go after those who are weak and vulnerable. So I had to teach my girls how to defend themselves, how to survive, how to the street smarts. My children are the targets that they are going to come after. And they're going to take my children and make me come to them because they don't want me on my turf. They want me on theirs. And I know that. I figured when I got into this fight that my husband would be like, hey, that's done, you know, about the time that the threat started. And instead, I got very, very lucky in finding my husband, and I couldn't do what I do without his support. When I get to those points when you lose so many of these children back, it's really tough to keep going. And he'll tell me, you can't give up on them because you're the only chance they have. So we keep fighting. I've had... Go ahead.
We've got 10 minutes of questions, so if it's okay to be
yes.
Open.
Absolutely.
Okay, and we're going to stop at 5:12, so we'll be sure to send it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yes.
Is there a mic at all?
On our way to the convention this last couple days, we came up through St. George, and there was a truck that passed us with a placard on the side of it that said, polygamy is abuse.
That's my truck.
That's your truck.
That's the driving too fast.
We got a ticket.
I'm sorry.
And my mouth dropped open. I thought, that's wonderful. And I thought, as you were talking, I wondered, is that placard available through your organization?
I'm actually getting T-shirts made with that say that.
Okay.
But that's actually a magnet that I, some magnetic signs that I have had made for my truck. A friend of mine made them that I put on my truck. And it's funny because I lost one of those signs right in the middle of Kingston Town here in Salt Lake about 2 years ago. Yeah, I can take them off if I need to go in after children, or so the magnetic is great. I only have one sign left right now, so I've got to get another one made for the other side of my truck.
Yeah,
Yes.
I'd like to ask Linda, in a sexually repressed society like Utah, I guess there's other religions, I guess the evangelicals, or maybe like this, have you done a comparison with how much sexual abuse occurs in those societies versus Mormonism, or is Mormonism way out in front?
Well, I don't. I've worked some Catholic cases. I've worked a Christian Faith Center case, a Salvation Army case, different cases. I wouldn't say that I'm an expert on that, but it's the rigid thinking that makes for the sexual abuse. It's the guys who are the black and white thinkers. They can't accept the maybes or the chaos, as our previous speaker was talking about. And so they flip. The women who have multiple personality disorder or dissociative states, a lot of people think there may be a genetic component to that, that that's how some people learn to deal with trauma. And I think that many of these perpetrators have those same dissociative states. They're Satan Saturday night. They're the bishop Sunday morning.
Question from Linda. Whereby extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence. And if you're gathering evidence for the courts, what kind of evidence do you look at besides hearsay evidence?
We have multiple people who admit having known about the abuse, like in the Ken Fleming case. There's physical evidence in some of the cases where, you know, in the West Virginia case where the children were taken to the hospital many times, but it was never reported as required by law. A lot of times, you're saying that in the Fleming case, it was hearsay. But they have reports from other groups, like a lot of our perpetrators were. One of the other things the Mormon Church does is if the Boy Scouts have, in a lot of the cases, our perpetrators have already been criminally prosecuted. So the evidence is already there, and it's not hearsay evidence. They're already convicted. But the Boy Scouts keep track of their perpetrators, and in some cases we've gotten those files from them. So other organizations have also known about this particular perpetrator. The Mormons, by the way, to get around the laws with the Boy Scouts, and I'm not saying every state does this. Certainly there are some good state presidents. But in several of our cases, Mormon who would not be allowed to work with children by the laws that the Boy Scouts go by. What they do is they allow him to be a Boy Scout leader, but they never report him as a Boy Scout leader to the Boy Scouts. So they allow these guys to work with children, but they don't report them. One of the things we'd like to see happen is for the church to start doing background checks on people who work with children. They don't do that either.
Just one note on that. If somebody doesn't have kids and they're a Boy Scout leader, that's a pretty good red flag.
Actually, it doesn't cost money to check that. I can't remember this man's name now, but he was from Florida. He spent $25,000 of his own money to pass a federal law that any nonprofit organization can check whether someone's a sexual offender for free.
This is more in the form of a comment and substantiation of what Linda's been saying. Grew up in a Mormon family, five generations deep, polygamy on both sides, and etc. But the child sexual abuse that takes place. My sister married a returned missionary, met at BYU. This young man had a history of abuse as a youth, but nonetheless was encouraged to go on a mission, came back, met my sister. They married. While she was pregnant with twins, he was arrested for abusing a young boy who he blamed for enticing him. This was back in Nebraska. Sent to prison. My dad, who I come from a somewhat, my dad was a prominent businessman in a business where five bishops ran a company. It's existent here in Salt Lake as well. Made arrangements through social services to get this man out of the state of Nebraska and into Utah. My father brought him into our family of a rather large family. We would hold family reunions up in the mountains. So my dad was president of the Granite School District, the board. So we would rent all the facilities there. This young man roamed as all the children were roaming around. It wasn't until my other sister walked in while he was sodomizing his two-year-old son, had sodomized both of his kids, that numerous other kids came up. When they told the bishop they wanted to cover it up, it wasn't until the other families finally sued, sent him to prison. The family still refused to leave him out of the family circle. And so this sort of thing is just overlooked. The church social services knew the history. My dad and the family covered it up, didn't let expose the other kids in the family to the abuse. So this is real. Goes on quite often.
We're going to have to stop for now, but I'm sure they would be more than willing to have answer some questions and talk with any of you privately if you have other questions for them. We're going to adjourn now. Okay, just a minute. We'll adjourn, and then at 1 o'clock will be Simon Southerton's presentation. We had to kind of scrunch lunch this year to get everything in, so you've only got an hour, but there is a restaurant here in the hotel. You have delicious food. I'm really not familiar with walking distance places, Dee, but there's other hotels close. So please be back right at 1 o'clock. Linda had one more thing to say.
I just want to say there were a few ritual abuse victims who came to my presentation, and I told them that I wasn't going to spend too much time on it, but on Sunday afternoon, if you want to get together with me, just see me, and I'll give you more information from my study. Thank you.